Hey everybody, I'd like you to join us in welcoming a new sponsor this week, which is Square. Now, you, like I, might know Square for their mobile card swiping solution that they used to have back in the day. It's a little thing you plug into your phone that go into your headphone jack and you could swipe credit cards. Yeah, well, Square is so much more now. They make it as simple as possible to start taking payments on your website. You can take payments online, in-app, and of course, in-person as well. You can accept debit, credit, and even these custom Square gift cards that are customized for your business, which sounds awesome. On the web, you can use Square Payments to fully customize the payment experience, so you can make the UI match the look and feel of your site exactly, so it doesn't feel like some off-the-shelf solution. You can even set up digital wallets like Apple Pay, Google Pay, and MasterPass, all in one swift go. Now, they know that this is a show for developers, so I'm going to give you a developer link right now. They want you to get started and check out developer.squareup.com/docs/payment-form/overview. You can peruse the docs and see just how easy it is to set up a custom payment form on your website.
I'm wiped out today.
Yeah, so I messaged you on Discord earlier. And you said, my computer is on silent mode today, though. Discording via the iPad, gotta get stuff done. And then I continued to bother you. But besides that point, what's going on over there?
Building the new app and also maintaining the current app. Yeah.
I don't know what that's like at all.
Yeah, exactly.
It's not a story as old as development itself.
Yeah, just tackling some more difficult things. I guess so, like the past few weeks talked about, you know, DK building the sister app, getting that going. So I originally started working on the front end, mostly kind of getting that scaffolded out, and then Jaggy took that over and he's doing a great job.
Not only did Jaggy take it over, he like took the reins and just disappeared into the sunset.
Yeah. He's doing great. He's doing great. He'll send me like videos every now and then of progress reports on different things, and it's awesome. So
it's what's great about it is it looks like a demo slide for a Tailwind UI. Like it's free, yeah. Tailwind UI marketing. I mean, he's going whole hog on that.
Yeah, and it's all really that. Yeah, I think it saved us a lot of time already. I think it's like already paid for the investment because we got a team license for Design Collective. And so the new app shell, we're not doing too many customizations to it yet because we just need to get this first, you know, version MVP out the door. Yeah, just a lot of the form components and things are straight just Tailwind UI that have been chopped up into view components. So it's working great. He's also just generally doing a good job architecting it. So I think one of my favorite things about this whole project is Design Collective has always been sort of it feels like you're sort of dragging an anchor around in terms of the technology it's concerned, right? Because it's been many different things in its lifespan so far. And so in making improvements and introducing improvements, because we're so small, it's really difficult to say like, all right, we're going to stop doing this other stuff now so that way we can refactor these tech pieces, right? That doesn't really make business sense to just do that.
Dragging the anchor is an apt analogy because you're literally turning the ship, right?
Yeah, quite literally. So what's really cool about this new project is that, you know, the front end can start from scratch. So we're using the same technologies, Tailwind, Vue, Nuxt. We're actually introducing TypeScript on this one. It's been something I've been wanting to do for a little while, and we can talk about that more in a little bit maybe, but it's been really nice because I go into the code base and it's so organized and clean, and a lot of things that I would love to clean up about DK is already just cleaned up with, I'll just call it SD, I guess, because that's the namespace. But so for example, we have like vendors and products and stuff. And so instead of just making queries, I guess like a lot of DK's page and container components just make XHR requests and stuff right from the page components. And instead of doing that with SD, we wanted to go a more Phoenix-ish approach, I guess, on the front end. So we actually have, I forget what the folder is called now, but basically all of the business logic or like specific to SD bits of code live inside of that area. So And we actually use inject with Nuxt to provide that. So in anywhere in the Nuxt app, you can do this.$ or app.$sd, and then you can have access to repositories. So like if you want to get products, you could do this.$sd.products.fetch or something like that. And then you could leave it like that, or you can actually override the default GraphQL that gets sent. But there's like update and all that stuff. So in that regard, like there's so much logic that's been pulled out of the actual page components and container components. And so it's really kind of separated out. So if we ever need to swap methods out or refactor things, the presentation, I guess, is separate. Just like DK or just like Phoenix has like the lib in the, or the, like the app and the app web directory.
Yeah. So I'm looking at RHR. I have a plugin, a custom plugin here called controllers.js. And so I have a bunch of singleton classes, JavaScript classes that I use the inject method for, and I inject them right into global scope of view. And I have 13 of them.
Right.
And I couldn't think of a better name. I just called them controllers, depending on, you know, whatever sort of scope of the application that they manage. But man, it's a really great pattern, because like you have, it's still encapsulated into a class, but it's a global singleton that you can still access from everywhere, which like that's just very valuable. And like I do things where like I have custom getters and setters on my controllers that just map to like the Vuex store. So like a getter would just pull something out of the Vuex state, and a setter function, like a property setter, would actually do like a Vuex mutation directly. So you have that really nice syntax, and you can bind to it and stuff. So that way, like you're literally in your view components, you can just do vbind to this property on a JavaScript class. And behind the scenes, it's just calling the Vuex getters and setters for you, because it's just a straight like dot whatever equals whatever.
Yeah, sure. I mean, and that stuff ultimately becomes repeated if you don't do that. So like in Design Collective, we have just like a lot of repeated code that could be refactored, but again, no time, no energy sort of thing, right?
Yeah, no, it's a really great pattern. And you know, abstracting away the GraphQL is nice. I mean, it's not like you're going to change it anytime soon, but it gives you flexibility to add other transport mechanisms if you want to, like, do some WebSocket stuff or whatever. That's all agnostic from the view component.
Yeah, exactly. And we're using GraphQL tag now, so we actually have like .graphql files, which has actually been really nice.
Wait, what is this?
GraphQL tag? Yeah. So in a nutshell, you can have .graphql files, or I suppose you could just pass in a GraphQL document, and it converts it to AST, and then you can pass it to, you can use it like with Apollo and stuff. Basically, what we're doing is instead of having static queries, I guess you would call them, in literal JavaScript strings, you just put them in a .graphql file, and you can import them just like normal and use them. And one really cool thing about this is that both VS Code and WebStorm, et cetera, have really good GraphQL plugins. So you can point the plugins at your GraphQL server, it'll run the introspection, and it'll create a mapping of the GraphQL schema for you, and then you get GraphQL auto-completion in IntelliSense in your editor as you're typing queries and stuff.
Yeah, see, this is cool because as much as I like the simplicity of just jamming strings together to make my GraphQL queries, this definitely has a lot more structure to it and is probably the more proper way to do it. Although, again, I haven't done any GraphQL mutations or queries or anything that are complicated enough to warrant something like this. And all my stuff is pretty straightforward, and I tend to prefer the just gigantic string approach versus like trying to form some weird REST API JSON query syntax that's custom to every application. But I could totally see a need for this.
Well, so one thing that gets really interesting, and I'll try to find this article. I can't remember where I saw it first or how I read it the first time, but maybe, you know, it might be in the Apollo docs. We found like with the Design Collective, the string style of doing things. And again, this could totally just because of rushing and stuff, but the string style of doing things, we ended up having a lot of repeated. So we might have like a product query repeated a few times throughout the app. And that's, you know, that's probably fine. But, you know, then you end up like searching and replacing if you have to make changes and stuff, which again, probably fine. But the more instances you have, the more, you know, vectors of error you have or opportunities to cause an error.
But it's more explicit, Sean. It's more explicit.
Sure. But with GraphQL tag, we're actually using fragments for a couple of things. And in the article I was mentioning will come into play here. But so we have like a vendor product fragment called vendor product form. And so the vendor product form fragment contains all the fields you would need to render a vendor product form on the client. There are a few different mutations, right? So there's like a upsert vendor product, so create or update. There's a delete one. There's get one maybe. And so instead of having strings with all the repeated fields, you can just use the fragment inside of the various queries that all need that same shape. And with the GraphQL tag, you can actually import fragments. And so when it runs through Webpack, it kind of stitches everything together for you.
Okay. Yeah. So this makes sense. So you make a fragment and then you import it somewhere else and you get that reuse.
Right.
You're kind of giving up the selectivity you get naturally out of GraphQL. Like you're still requesting all the fields. I'm using like air quotes here, right? Like you're still requesting Sure. the same fields for every request. Whereas with GraphQL, one of the benefits is you can select just a subset that you need, but yeah, for your kind of application, you're not mobile and you don't care about bandwidth and, you know, you probably don't care as much for that kind of limitation.
Well, so here's the difference though. So you can still, I guess this is where the article comes into play. So Apollo was talking about, or the Apollo article is talking about a way of approaching using GraphQL and using fragments and stuff, or even adding these queries that I hadn't thought about. And so, I'm trying to remember what the example they used, but basically instead of like having a vendor product query that gets all the vendor product fields and a vendor query that gets all the vendor fields, what if you had separate query files for different pieces of your UI? So what if you had a vendor product card query and then maybe a vendor product data row query? You could basically chop it up as much as you need. And so each one of those specific queries maps to one of your pieces of UI and only gets the fields that it needs at that point. So you still get the selectivity. Maybe minimalism is maybe the right word, but you know, you get the data that you need for that specific piece of UI. And then as the UI changes, you can adjust that one query, which doesn't break other queries across the board, as long as, you know, they're not using that UI piece of specific query, like they shouldn't be. But that was an interesting approach because I hadn't thought about that. And I kind of like it quite a bit. And so that's what actually pushed me to using GraphQL tag, because it was a little bit easier to manage these different snippets with it.
Yeah, this is really interesting. I could totally see that. And yeah, splitting it up into different fragments makes sense. This fragment keyword, this is not a part of the GraphQL spec, right? This is just something to do with this one particular library.
No, it's part of the GraphQL spec.
It is, really? Okay.
Yeah.
I guess I got to do some reading.
Yeah, it's really interesting.
It's also kind of at odds with the way, and again, I'm so used to using Vuex or Redux or, you know, like having a single global store of state in your client. And the way that you kind of want to store things in there is as flat and as comprehensive as possible, right? You kind of want to just kind of throw things into buckets and then draw the relationships between them at runtime, basically. Whereas GraphQL really wants you to just query what you want, and also everything's nested, right? All the relations to your sort of parent query or node, I should say, field are come down with the field. So all like the children and their siblings and lists of things and everything. It's really kind of, like I said, at odds with the way Vuex kind of wants you to work things. And, you know, it feels wrong to have duplicates of data. You know, as developers, we want to dry things up, right? We don't want to have to write code twice. And we definitely don't want to store data twice if we can help it. Even if it's just temporary, it just feels weird. So yeah, I guess like I'm okay with the benefits that GraphQL and especially Absinthe on the server side provides me as a developer without having the need to like go this deep into slap chopping my requests up for particular use cases.
That makes sense. I mean, thinking about the specific, our specific use cases too, like you saying it's at odds is pretty accurate, I suppose. Like if you look at something like Vuex ORM, where really you toss everything into it and then you you get a little aura on top of your store. There are other tools like Apollo and stuff. They sort of cache this information for you. So even if you have different shapes, it's all kind of like magically managed behind you. You don't have to worry about it. But, you know, in our case, I was trying to think about, you know, making sure if the editors are going to be working on this data, one thing I didn't want to have to worry about, especially, is having to manually update a state or some sort of cache, in-memory cache of information that's fetched. And so far, I mean, things are fast enough. Like, we can go that route. I could always just chuck Apollo in there if you want to put the Apollo store or the Apollo cache in there. But I think from us right now, out of the gate, especially as we're working through our initial data sets, the ability to make sure that what the person is editing is the real most up-to-date data and not accidentally, you know, if we're feeling like, you know, there's only two of us building this thing. So I would rather have them have like bare metal access, for lack of a better term, to the data, as opposed to working with a cache store up front. So, I mean, we can weigh that as it goes, but that's my approach up front, I suppose.
You know how to get really close to the data store, right? Just use Live View for everything. You're writing directly to the database. I'm just trolling. Ignore me.
Yeah. Well, that's the pitch, right? That's one of the pitches for Live View, I guess. But yeah, so that's what I've been going through. I think is like, you know, Jaggy working on this front end side of thing, and that allows me to kind of deep dive into the background. But again, us being so small, it's you need more than a few hours at a go during a day to be able to really get something done, to really make some progress. And it's really hard for me to get that because, you know, talking to the sales team, talking to my boss, talking to the support team, you know, talking to Jaggy a little bit here and there. And then apart, you know, like watching for emails or people asking for stores, asking for stuff, you know, and throughout all the communication, trying to like figure out when I can shut down and tell everyone to leave me alone and get some work done. So that's what I've been doing is just putting my laptop in do not disturb mode. So I don't see any pop-ups or anything, and trying to not use Slack on the desktop as much as possible, because it's my fault, but I always feel like I have to respond really quickly with Slack. It's just really ingrained in me by now. It's harder to get out of that habit. So, I find that just not having it open on the desktop or Discord for that matter helps a lot. And so I just have my iPad sitting on the side of my desk, and periodically I'll look at it and see if there's anything critical for me to look at. But that's been really helpful in affording me time to really sort of think for extended periods of time about problems I'm trying to solve.
So you're treating Slack the same way that I treat email.
Yeah.
Never have email notifications on. I never have push notifications on for email on my phone. Check it when I check it, and you get a reply when I reply to you.
Right. Yeah. That's what I'm trying to do. It's hard, but I'm trying that.
Yeah. I'm definitely a really bad offender with the Slack thing, especially because I have, this really kills me, but the two main Slacks where I spend all my time are my company Slack and the Elixir Slack, where I'm always just like going back and forth. And I was on there the other day and someone posted a question, and I immediately posted an answer because it was a simple question. And it was just like, I had to point him at the right API and the docs and stuff. And he's like, that's the fastest I've ever received a response from anyone. And I had to take a step back and I'm like, oh, maybe I'm spending too much time here.
Yeah. Yeah.
No, I think it's good to step away from a little bit. I have taken your advice more recently and tried to, like, I literally just quit Slack and Discord and try to get some work done. It's good until things are on fire and then you have to log back in.
Yeah. Hopefully that's not too often.
That's the idea.
That's the idea. Yeah. Yeah. I've been really just trying to dig in more. Like, I've been feeling slow lately, if that makes any sense. Like, I was actually talking to Paul about this earlier because I was mentioning how I've been feeling kind of slow. So I've been sort of doing another deep dive into like Postgres and SQL and looking at SQL design patterns and stuff. I feel like the past few months, even maybe in the past year, it's been harder for me to retain information. And yeah, I was talking to Paul about that. He says that when he's stressed or when he's really busy, he feels kind of the same way. It's like, just you feel a little bit slower. It's a little bit harder to grasp or like recall what you were just reading about. And for me, I think a lot of that's distraction. A lot of that's not being able to completely focus. Like, my mind is subconsciously always thinking about other things, whether that's how much stuff I have to do or has anyone messaged me on Slack, or is Rockwell trying to, you know what I mean? Like the constant sort of background chatter.
Don't drag me into this.
But have you ever felt like that? Just like a little bit slower than normal?
Oh yeah. I mean, all the time, man. I always wish I was more productive. Come on. But I definitely have cycles. It's really, really you could probably plot it and it would be like a perfect sine wave. Like those are the kind of cycles that I go through. And during the slow periods, it's almost, I don't want to say depression, because like that's like a real thing that is a real problem for lots of people, and it's not for me, but that's what it feels like, because it feels like no matter what you do, no matter how much you just try to like sit down and focus and get things done, it just doesn't happen. And it's like, no one can tell you, oh, just do work. Just work harder. Like it's telling someone who's depressed, just be happy. Have you tried not being sad?
Right.
Right? Like that's kind of the feeling of, again, helplessness is too strong of a word, but that's the feeling that you get where it's like a writer's block, you know, that kind of thing where mm-hmm. you, the harder you think about it, the more you just stress yourself out. Yeah, man, it happens all the time. I think especially it's natural for people working from home where you're in the same environment all the time. You don't really have the sort of maybe disconnect of like, I'm at work, I'm at home. That can be like a big distraction and a big problem, you know, whether people claim it is or not. I think that's a real thing. Multitasking is definitely a real thing. I have lean on the side of that most people are actually not that good at multitasking at all. I know I'm not.
Right.
And that multitasking is really just doing a lot of things poorly. So like all those things can definitely add up. And if they all kind of converge at a single time, that's a real downer, and that's the real productivity killer for me. And especially if, and the other thing is like compacting it when you actually do the work, if it's not interesting work, if it's just kind of rehashing the same stuff, or especially if you're doing rewrites or refactors or doing documentation or support, like you're not actively building something new and solving a cool problem. I mean, that's just called having a job, right?
Like, yeah,
that's it. So I don't know. All those things are kind of what really bring me down personally.
Yeah, sure. Yeah. I mean, a lot of that is stuff that I'm going through too, even, you know, just this is the longest I've ever had the same job, you know? So I guess it's like finding ways to keep interested, and I'm, you know, definitely interested in the new app and building it. But I think like what's keeping me interested now, and I'm starting to like fight back up to the, you know, the upswing on that sine wave. But just learning, like getting the foundations right, not kind of slapping it together quickly, but getting the foundations really right. That's been really, really, I don't know, fun to chase after, I guess. So that's sort of what pushed me back to looking for different SQL books or SQL patterns, I suppose. So that's one thing that you and I kind of rubber duck about a lot is, you know, database structures, designs, or like, what are the trade-offs of X and Y? And I found this book. I'll put the link to it in the show notes. It's something Database Design Patterns, Volume 3. I'll put the link to the show notes. But I like this book a lot because, you know, I should probably just go and look up the title for this thing. But I like this book a lot because it has a bunch of different patterns that it takes you through. Just sort of, you know, here are things that apply to many different companies, whether, you know, some people might say like, oh, patterns aren't really useful for SQL because businesses are different and you have to find out what works for your business. But honestly, there's a ton of overlap in most businesses. So patterns would make sense to learn there. So it's sort of just like putting tools in my toolbox, right? But basically it'll take a pattern. So one of the patterns I was reading about is how would you store contact information for users or organizations in your database or for your company? And so like the easiest one would be like if you have a store, just slap contact email on it, or contact phone or whatever, you know. And that's obviously the easiest one. And so it takes you through that, and then it goes, here are the drawbacks. Like as you grow, here's what becomes difficult. Data normalization becomes difficult. All this stuff becomes difficult. So then it goes, okay, well here's level two pattern for this, and then here's a level three pattern for this, which is the most abstracted away, the most normalized, but also the most difficult to implement. And I'm getting a lot of value out of this book now because I really like that it does like that tiered approach. because sometimes when I'm looking around, like, how should I structure this thing? I find these articles are all like straight to level three right away, you know, and it's sort of intimidating or off-putting, or it's like, that's so much work. I don't need that level of abstraction right now, you know? So this book is good at providing like the middle ground area and the pluses and minuses of all the different approaches.
That's cool. And it's nice because it's sort of language agnostic. I mean, it's SQL, but everything talks to a SQL database. So you can, and plus just learning the patterns, think about how to store referential data and stuff, I think is just as valuable. So that's pretty cool. It's not something that I think developers would normally think to seek out. Like, everyone's like, I got to learn this language, I got to learn this framework, but not like, I want to learn the fundamentals of database development. But of course, like, that's a thing that you should know.
There, I saw a really interesting tweet, and I'll have to find this one too. I can't remember. I feel so terrible because I can't remember who said what, or like what the book was called. But the tweet was talking about job interviews, and she was like, all these job interviews I'm doing are, they're like giving me a marker and telling me to like create a pattern on a whiteboard, or like create a solution on a whiteboard. And she's like, I'm a pattern matcher, not a pattern creator. Like, my day job is looking for the right pattern or abstraction and applying it. I don't have to invent all this stuff because it's already been invented. And I read that and I was like, she's right.
That was one of the cool things when I actually took a data structures and algorithms class in college. And I was like, oh, that's what that's called. Like, you just end up naturally deriving these things. And like, oh, that has a name. That pattern is a known quantity that you can actually talk to other people about.
Exactly. It gives you a common terminology. If you can say something, it gives you a common ground, like right out of the gate. You know what something is called, then you can communicate about it more effectively. But so that's why I ended up going and looking for a SQL pattern book, because I could brush up more on what you can actually do with Postgres, like all the different features it has. It has so many. But I'm getting way more mileage out of generalized, here's how you might go about storing contact information, and here's like what you might struggle with if you choose approach 1, 2, or 3. That's been huge for me.
And the other nice thing is that Ecto is so close to the database that you can actually take advantage of that stuff without having to work around the framework, right? Ecto gives you, and not even escape hatches, like Ecto just gives you direct access to interfacing with whatever kind of database or structure you want.
Yeah. And one thing I've been doing with Ecto specifically, I guess like stemming from thinking about referential integrity, or thinking about more specifically thinking intentionally about like, okay, well, if this thing is deleted, what happens to its associations and stuff? Should it be nullified? Should it be deleted? Should nothing happen? Should it keep that foreign, you know what I mean? Keep that foreign key. So that led me down the rabbit hole of looking, trying to figure out. So like today I spent some time looking at Ecto, the reference function. So if you're making a migration and you want to add a foreign key relationship to a table, from one table to another, you might have a line that says like add vendor product ID references vendor products. And then you can pass it a keyword list of options, like what happens on change of the relationship. Like if the thing it belongs to changes, what happens if the thing it belongs to is deleted? And more specifically, I was trying to figure out what side effects happen. So like if you create a foreign key relationship, it's going to automatically create a constraint for that foreign key. So say you have a vendor product ID on a product, so that product belongs to a vendor product, right? So by default, if you don't specify anything, it's going to create that constraint. And so if you delete that vendor product, it's going to complain because it's like, hey, there's a F key over here and this thing needs to exist because this product belongs to it, right? So you have some sort of referential integrity there, meaning you can't break the foreign key relationships there. And so I was like, well, I didn't specify that. How is this happening? You know? So I ended up having to go like digging through docs and looking to see like what actually was going on behind the scenes.
And then there's the question of, do you even want that to happen in the database? Is that an application concern? Do you consider the database's triggers? And I think referential key constraints and stuff are sort of a given. Like, that's the job of the database. But when you start to go into the domain of cascading deletes and that kind of stuff, stored procedures and views, you know, SQL views, definitely gets a little muddy. We've talked about that before. We discussed that quite a bit. I think we've kind of landed on mostly using the SQL database as a dumb store, but
yep.
That's not how a lot of people do things. Like, there's definitely reasons why you want to do that. The database is insanely powerful, especially Postgres these days. It does so much cool, cool stuff.
Yeah, yeah. So I didn't even know computed columns were a thing. So, you know, we're storing, I have these things we call computer properties. So on a table, so we might have a column that is the result of a mathematical equation, but that happens in the code. That doesn't happen in the field level. I didn't know that you could define fields that have, that display the result of a calculation.
Yeah, I had no idea. Today I learned.
Yeah, so in these books I've been reading, they're like, don't do this in most cases. I'm like, wait, what? How do I? And then I didn't know it was a totally separate thing they're talking about. But yeah, so that's a lot of what the book was also talking about. So like you're talking about, you know, foreign key relationships and constraints and cascading deletes. That's one of the things it was talking about, is like learn the trade-off. So yeah, SQL can do this for you. And it can be very powerful because that means that there's a lot of code that you don't have to write. But in some cases, especially as your application grows and your business concerns get larger, you might need to take that off and handle it in the code. Even though there's a chance that you could break something because it's not happening automatically, it's, you know, you need greater control over what's happening behind the scenes. And so one thing that I've always struggled a little bit with Ecto is, there's sort of two sides to that coin, right? So when you're creating a migration, to say like if you want to apply a cascading delete, you can do that on the database side. And then you can do it in the Ecto side without it existing in the database, but the database always kind of overrides what you have specified in the code at that point, which can be confusing if you don't already know that's happening. And that's bitten me a few times because I'm like, well, I changed the relationship in the Ecto schema. Why is this not happening? And then I realized, oh, I need to write a migration to change this on the database level. And then you have to worry about what about schemaless queries and writes? So like if you're using repo to update all or delete all, that's not going to go through your schemas if you're using a schemaless query. So you might bypass that altogether. So that's something to think about too.
Yeah, you got to know what you're doing there.
Yeah. So that's what I mean by being more intentional about it. Yeah, you really do got to know what you're doing there. And I feel like, especially with frameworks, it's really easy to sort of just gloss over that information, gloss over those details. So yeah, if I'm glassy-eyed right now, that's why. I'm mulling over this stuff.
Now, the real question is, I should have been paying attention, SQL or SQL?
I don't know, I call it SQL.
Yeah, okay. I think that's, I don't want to say the right way, but SQL definitely seems like why bother? I know we got time for that.
Well, you have MySQL and PostgreSQL.
Right.
So who knows?
Can't win.
Who knows?
What about Microsoft?
What, MS SQL? I've heard it both ways, honestly. Yeah. So I hear you've been typing up some Rust over there.
So yeah, my interest was piqued a little bit. I can explain the genesis of this very briefly, but the short version is that I wanted to, there's some project ideas we have in relation to the business and digital signal processing and SDR, software-defined radio, and a lot of that involves doing really, really fast math calculations. And it turns out that Rust is really, really good at doing things really, really fast in terms of crunching numbers, and so I had an idea that Rust was going to be this kind of solution for DSP needs that I thought I might have at some point. I did a quick survey of kind of languages. Obviously, Rust and Go are like the two kind of butting heads right now. But the promises that Rust has with, it's basically C, but you get tons of type safety and, I mean, the typing system in Rust is insane. I haven't even like gotten into it at all yet, but the safeties and guarantees and the helpful messages of the compiler are all very, very, it was just really, really compelling. I ordered the book, they call it, I'm using air quotes again, the book. it's not right next to me. I forget the title of it. It's just Programming Rust's 2018 version. About a third of the way through it right now, you know, and just getting the basics down. And I'm at like initial impression stage here, because I've just been messing around with the examples and little playing around with demo projects. And I hopped in the Rust Discord and I've been asking questions and got some nice answers there. So that was nice. So far, my first impression was really like I was blown away by how similar Rust is to Swift. And I'm talking about real basics here, and I'm not talking about any of the macOS frameworks or anything. I'm just talking about the language itself. And I don't really know the timeline. I don't know which came first or what was influenced by what. But man, they have a lot of the same features that work very, very similarly. Rust and Swift both have what I call baby pattern matching. You know, now it's not as powerful as Elixir's pattern matching, but it does allow you to create some really nice control structures around their very, very powerful enums. I think that's the right way to pronounce it. Enum, enum. I never know. Short for enumeration.
I call them enums.
Yeah, enum, right. Really, really powerful enums, and obviously generics are a whole thing, which I haven't even gotten into yet. It's really, really nice, and I really, again, just having the confidence that the compiler like checks the type safety of everything, it's just, it gives you a lot of confidence to, even though you're working at a very low level, I feel like I have enough tools to and libraries to guide me in the right direction to get done what I want to get done. So that's kind of where I'm at right now. Again, just still in the playing around phase. The package manager system just works. Everything compiles and runs. VS Code has a really, really good support for Rust in terms of like you hover over things and it shows you all the types for everything, which is great.
That's awesome.
It even has a plugin for their crate. Oh God, I already forgot the name of the terminology. When you put the packages in and you type like package and then you put the version number, it goes to the web and checks that version number is the most recent and gives you like a little thumbs up if it's accurate, right, in VS Code.
Oh, cool.
And if it's like an old version, it like gives you an arrow or something. It says, hey, you should upgrade to this version. Little things like that are pretty nice.
Little experiences like that really, really add up for me. So I've actually, we don't have to talk about this right now, but I've been using VS Code more recently because the Elixir plugin is just, it's pretty good, and the IntelliJ one is intense, but it's not quite as good, I think, as the Elixir, the VS Code plugin.
Yeah, it's really hard because there are so many good editors now, and when you're trying to find the specific thing for your language, it's a really fine line between like what's actually supported and updated and is actually going to help you and works the way you want. I know you really love the IntelliJ stuff, but you know, maybe the value of having the same UI everywhere is worth it for you. I don't know.
Yeah.
I'm not here to make you switch editors back.
That sounds all pretty good. Like it seems like the basic experience is all there. And were there any like foot guns or gotchas that you had to kind of stumble through?
My biggest mental roadblock right now is how Rust deals with, I don't even know the right terminology, I don't want to say pointers, but it's like ownership of variables. So normal variables, like, I can't say strings, but like integers and booleans and floats and stuff, those are all, everything is passed by value, right? When you call a function, that variable is copied and put onto the stack. And so it's passed into the function, you get a copy of it. So if you make changes to it, it's not going to affect the caller. But when you're dealing with things on the heap, things like strings or objects or, you know, classes and stuff, you have to keep track of who owns that memory, because you don't want to deallocate that memory while someone's still using it. You don't want to keep that memory around and have it leak because you lost ownership of it and now you can't release it. And you also don't want to try to access parts of that memory that you don't have access to. For example, reading off the end of an array or accessing some struct that member that doesn't exist.
Mm-hmm.
So Rust has this concept of ownership where, and again, it's confusing because they use the same syntax that C and C++ use for pointers and dereferencing. So they use the ampersand and the asterisk, but they don't actually, you're not actually dealing with raw pointers. You're still, you're dealing in Rust land with this ownership concept. And instead of like a pointer and a dereference, it's like borrowing. So if you have an ampersand, it's like, hey, I'm just, I know you, you the caller own this object, but I'm just going to borrow it and get access to it. But it's your responsibility as the function caller to clean it up when you're done. Like, I'm not going to try to allocate or deallocate things. There's no reference counting like Objective-C, and I assume, I think Swift has. There's one ownership. It's basically reference count of one. And you can pass that ownership around, and I don't quite understand the mechanics of that. The short version of this is that it's you can kind of get cryptic errors where you don't really understand A, what the problem is, and B, how to fix it. Because you don't have an intimate understanding of how this ownership borrowing memory system works, you're just out of luck. Like there's nothing you can do to fix it besides reading more. So that's been the biggest thing for me so far.
Gotcha. Yeah, it sounds pretty intense.
Yeah, that's the power of it. Again, it happens at compile time, so it's not like you're going to get a panic or a crash. You can fix it before your program runs. But, you know, you just have to get the program to run first. but there's a pretty good guarantee that when you do get it to run, it's going to be correct in terms of memory management.
That's cool.
I just also want to say the other reason I got into Rust was because of the library Rustler, which is an Elixir library that allows you to get into and out of, basically call into Rust natively from Elixir using NIFs, Erlang NIFs, which I'm pretty sure is what...
Dave. Friend of the show, Dave.
I'm sure that's what friend of the show, Dave, was using for his number crunching betting stuff. And you know what? That was my first proof of concept. It's like, I needed to do this FFT, which is a fast Fourier transform. It's this DSP algorithm. I want to see like, hey, can I do an FFT from Elixir? And I found a native Elixir library that just does it in Elixir. And I ran some benchmarks and it came out to, you know, some speed. And then I did Rustler and I found a Rust crate for doing FFTs, and I called that from Elixir, and it was something like 100,000 times faster. It was stupid. It was stupid how fast it was. And I was like, okay, this is real.
Yeah, that's pretty compelling. 100,000 times faster.
And this is it's supposed to be the fast Fourier transform, but you want it to be fast.
I want to go fast.
Gotta go fast.
Gotta go fast. That's right. That's cool, man. That sounds... I feel like I don't have the bandwidth right now. So picking up Java a little bit here and there, picking up Go a little bit here and there. I guess like I have to commit to a project, but that feels like I should be using my brain cycles to finish this other thing first. This SD thing first. So I don't know, but I really like, I've been wanting to pick up something like C Sharp or something more than just creating a simple project and moving on. So. Maybe in a few months when I get further along the road with this other thing, I'll be able to do that.
It's a weird thing that I haven't done in a while to learn a language just for the sake of learning it. You know, everything I've learned has been a means to an end for the past several years, right? I learned Elixir because I knew that the model that it adapted was a perfect fit for application. And I learned Vue and Nux because that was a way better way to write front-end applications than 7,000 lines of jQuery, no joke. And so that's all been great and great experience, but this is the first time where I'm just like, this is cool, and I want to know enough about it to know when to use it. You know, it's like taking a 101 course in college. It's like, do I want to be an anthropologist? Probably not, but I want to learn about anthropology. Also, it's required, but
sure.
So it's kind of fun being in that mindset and just be like, oh, playing around. And I don't know, it just brings me back to kind of older days when I was learning lots of new stuff just for the sake of it, because it was new and cool and interesting. And I just wanted to try building things. And this is an area of my development tool belt that is empty. There's an empty loop there on my belt that's not filled for this low-level, systems-level, really fast, cross-compiled code. You know, I can do cross-platform applications with Electron. I can do C-sharp WinForms app. apps, I can do iOS apps, I can do web apps in Elixir and Rails and whatever. But if I want to do something that's really, really down and dirty, close to the processor, I'm not comfortable working in a C style environment. It's just not for me. It's too much. Too much.
Right. What I guess this is my last question for now, but what made you pick that over Go?
I remember briefly looking at Go in the past, and I just didn't like it.
Fair enough.
I don't know, the way that Rust is marketed seemed like it made sense to me, and what Go is trying to accomplish is really not clear to me. The concurrency model is weird, and that's the big push, and I tried to work with it, and I don't know, I see more, I feel like I've seen more negative things about Go than positive things. So
sure.
I don't know, that's it's not very scientific, you know. Maybe I'll look at it at some point, but this Rust just seemed like it seemed like a good fit for problems that I'm going to be solving.
Yeah, I mean that makes sense. That's why I asked is like why, you know, what helped you come to the decision to choose one or the other, and it's not necessarily looking for like personal bias. It's more so learning that it seemed like Rust was marketed more towards specifically exactly what you want to do, whereas, like you said, Go is sort of more marketed as a general purpose sort of lower level language.
Yeah, I think that's fair. I don't think Rust is trying to be everything to everyone. I think it is trying to meet a very specific need, for sure.
Right.
Again, this is all of a third of the way through the book and, you know, a couple days of writing Fibonacci sequence in VS Code. I'm not exactly an expert here, so ask me again in 6 months when I've actually tried to build something using it.
Hold on, let me put a note in my calendar. Well, if anyone out there has Rust experience and wants to send Rockwell a lifeboat, he'd probably appreciate that.
I also want to know how they got the name Rust. I guess I could just look it up, but it doesn't seem very forward-thinking.
To me, it feels like a fitting name for like a low-level language, yeah.
Like, this actually, you just got to deal with it. I guess you could think of it as like Rust kind of, it's oxidization that forms on the outside of the metal, but it also protects the metal, right? So it's kind of like, you can still use it, like you can have an I-beam and it still has strength, but you're not going to be, it's not exposed to the elements because the Rust is kind of, I'm really reaching here.
An I-beam like Cyclops or what?
An I-beam, a beam that's shaped like a metal beam girder holding up things.
Here I am picturing that dude from what, X-Men, that shoots the beam out of his face.
An IB.
Too literal.
Kill me.
Was that his name, Cyclops? I don't remember.
Cyclops, yeah.
Didn't really watch X-Men.
You can always reach us on Twitter. Show is DNCcast. Sean is Sean Washbot, and I am Shrockwell.
And I am Shrockwell.
I'm Shrockwell.
And as always, show notes will be available at dnc.show. I'll put links to everything we mentioned today, the books I mentioned. I'm going to try and track down that tweet about pattern matching, not pattern creating. If I can't, I don't know what to tell you.
Shout out Kirk Douglas.
Who's that?
He's Spartacus. All right. This is a train wreck.
Going off the rails.
We'll also post show notes over on spectrum.chat. You can come have a discussion with us there. Come say hi. Period.
Oh, and as always, thank to Spec for having us and putting us out into the world and allowing us to have a train wreck of conversations like we're having right now.
Definitely not going to edit this at all.
Yeah, definitely not. Well, I'm going to go eat dinner and probably read a little bit more, read some more books.
Nerd. All right. Have a good night.
All right. See ya.
Thanks again to Square for sponsoring this week's episode. Square makes it simple to start taking payments from your site with a customized user interface that matches the look and feel of your application. Check out the link in the show notes to learn more. We'll be right back.
Spoilers, no spoiling.
Was that swiper, no swiping, but spoilers, no spoiling?
Yeah. Yeah, it was.
Shout out friend of the show, Dora.